So I'm going to summarize for just a moment. So we live inside this bubble, and as a result, we really are not free. That's the fundamental notion. Our minds have been made up for us in advance. So, consistent with the way we've been looking at that for a while, you can look at it in terms of stories, and you say, well, people live in their stories, you know, they make sense of the world in a certain way, or probably it's better to say we make sense of the world in a certain way. And I had asked you, I think it was in the orientation for week one, I had asked you to just as a practice be looking at how it is that people that people live out their stories. So, and the suggestion, the assignment, was that if you look at people that you encounter in your daily life, you know, kind of, especially in just casual interactions, you can really see how people inhabit a particular story. And you know, it's so much a part of them that they're certainly not aware of it. And this is true for us. It's not like we're making judgments about other people. But the assignment, the suggestion, was to look at people that you meet in daily life. So I'm going to ask you, I gave you warning in the orientation for this week, that I was going to ask you, have you had a chance to look at that, and what did you notice? So I'm going to ask for people's comments, if anybody wants to.
Well, this is Hayward. As a psychotherapist,
yes.
I sat and I listened and watched people embody their story and describe the world that they perceived and how it was all affecting and influencing themselves, that they were demonstrating a certain way of knowing the world to be and a certain experience of themselves, and they were speaking the story.
Yeah. So is that, you know, for you, Hayward, and especially because you've been working with TSK a long time, I would imagine that this was not a new insight for you. This was kind of what you do, right?
Well, it's not new, but it's always fresh.
Yeah. That makes sense. That makes sense to me that in a certain sense, I mean, part of what you notice about people when you notice them telling their stories is that the stories are stale. You know, that is, people just tell the same story in different variations over and over. But it's fresh to notice that. It's fresh to realize that. And so would you say that part of what you're trying to do in therapy is get people to recognize their stories?
That's part of it. The other part of it is to realize the state specificity of the story they tell, so that when they're in a depressed state, they see themselves a certain way and they see the world a certain way. And out of that state, the perception changes, so that the self-reflective nature of all of the perception is something that
mm-hmm.
I work with.
Okay, well, that makes very good sense, actually. I hadn't really thought about using that in a therapeutic sense, but that makes good sense. Okay, so I'm getting blurry again? Okay, I can't get the phone any closer, but I can try to speak up. I'm sort of crawling into the phone right now. Okay, so
I'm sorry.
It's okay. So Lois has a comment, and okay. Well, Lois, that's interesting. You said you found people were not receptive to being asked to observe themselves. Let's stay with that perception for a moment, that observation. That was not really part of the assignment, but I'm not surprised that that's the case. I mean, I've had, not very often, but it has happened to me that I've actually gotten into fights with people, you know, whom I consider to be good friends, when I asked them to notice or suggested that they were involved in a story, right, that they were involved in their own bubble, to use that image for a moment. What I find is people resent that. They feel like you're challenging something that's dear to them, that you're challenging their identity or challenging the truth that they believe in, that they live, and suggesting that maybe it's not true, and they don't like that.
A lot of attachment to their view.
Right, right.
And I found it very exasperating, typical sometimes. Contrary to my view of myself, I felt like I was attracted to seeing that. And it released me from my attachment to trying to do something in a particular instance, for example.
You mean which?
So, I felt tortured by a decision.
Okay, I lost just a little of that. Are you saying that you were feeling tortured by a decision or someone else was?
No, I said was that it was contrary to what I noticed about myself. Instead of resentment towards the observation, I felt that grateful that I could no longer be tortured by my decision because I saw outside the restriction.
Okay. Okay, good. Good. That seems very much to the point of what we're looking at here, you know. The very decision or the very commitment to look at our stories, and that can be helped by looking at the stories of other people, begins to open those up, begins to loosen them up. And it's a little bit like what Hayward said about situations being state-specific. I mean, Hayward, you were talking, it seemed, more about affective situations like depression. But in general,
it also would apply to being tired, to
right.
being hungry.
Okay. Okay.
You know, all of those, and then the normal, you know, being irritated and frustrated.
Right.
Because things aren't the way I want them to be.
Right. 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 Well, yeah. So all of those dimensions, and I think it also applies on the level of interpretation. You know, that is,
exactly.
Yeah. You recognize, given all of that, you realize that the story that's in effect at that moment is not necessarily the final word. You know, the way things are. For all time, carved in stone. Or another way to say that is that the bubble doesn't confine us completely. Or, you know, it does, but it's also possible that it could pop and become another bubble. And in fact, that is what happens all the time. Anybody else? Okay.
Hey, Jack, Robert here.
Yeah.
The one thing I noticed the most when I started focusing on this whole story idea was the what was taking place in the moment. When you started focusing on the idea of a story, you became much more aware that what was happening in the particular moment had much to do with, you know, the previous chapters in the story, that the people were reflecting so much of, you know, what had happened previously to them, and whether it was in their emotional state or in the way they were telling their story, that you became much more aware of what had led up to that moment related to the past, or to the past story.
Yeah, okay, that's good.
The conditioning, how the past conditions the interpretation in the present.
Right, right. So in this chapter, you know, we talk about positions or positioning and conditioning. So right now you're focusing on the conditioning. And I think that's one of the benefits, actually, of doing an analysis in terms of stories, because, you know, we're used to thinking of stories in terms of having a past and a present and at least potentially a future. And so it leads us to look at the past. So if you take an image like the bubble, you have to kind of remind yourself when it comes to the bubble that part of what is in the bubble is your sense of what has led up to this moment. No, but that's already
Jack,
yeah.
Jack, what I've noticed is that people people's memory of the past
mm-hmm.
is also state-specific. So if they're in a depressed state, they remember all the unhappy things that they believe is causing the current depression,
mm-hmm.
rather than considering the possibility that the current depression has a lot of unhappy memories in it.
Right. Right. No, that's actually, that's a nice way of saying it, because it helps make the point that we tend to think of the past as something that is done and gone, but in fact, you know, the past is always already, or is always a part of what's going on in this very moment.
Yeah, exactly.
And so if our present changes in the sense of depression, to stay with that example, if we're feeling depressed, then there's a certain past which goes with that. And that's what you just said, Hayward. I'm just rephrasing it. So, okay. Okay, well, let's look. That opens us up into the whole question of positions and conditioning. And actually, I mean, I think what people were saying about conditioning is good, and so I don't want to focus on that as much. And there's another reason I don't want to focus on it as much, and that is that maybe because we do have a kind of a psychological focus in our culture, we are fairly tuned in to the idea of being conditioned. That doesn't mean we know what to do about it, and it doesn't mean that we understand it, and it doesn't mean that we understand the relation of the past to the present in a fruitful way. That's what we were just talking about. But we do kind of understand the idea that we are conditioned by what has happened in the past, and that limits our freedom. It limits the possibilities that are open to us, and we would like to break free of that conditioning. So all of that is pretty easy for people to understand, at least conceptually. Doing it is a different story. But I want to focus a little more about position, or on the whole notion of positions, because we are not as used to thinking about it that way.
Thank you.
Say that again.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you. It's getting muffled at the bottom end of your sentences.
At the bottom end of my sentences. Well, that sounds like if I just upped my bottom end, it would work. So I will try that. And I hope I don't. Okay, I hope I don't become too loud. But it sounds like that's not the risk. So let's see. So I was starting to talk about positions, and I was saying that although we understand the notion of breaking free of conditions, it's not something we ordinarily think of to say that, you know, we want to break free of or drop our commitment to having a particular position. And we do say that actually in arguments, don't we? We say, you know, you're holding on to your position, you're not willing to allow for other possibilities, something like that. But that's on the conceptual level. I'm talking about something a little bit different, which is that we take a stand. And that's a phrase that comes up in Love of Knowledge. We take a stand on a particular position, and it limits, just like conditioning, it limits our possibilities. So, you know, we do say, yeah, my position is, and that has to do with our beliefs. But the more fundamental position is the one of the bystander. And I want to talk about the bystander, but not immediately. I want to talk about a couple of other things first. But that was the term that's introduced in this chapter, and it's certainly also in the first TSK book. The idea that the self occupies a particular position with respect to everything else in the world, and that's the position of the bystander. What I want to do before we actually go into the bystander is raise a couple of examples, bring up a couple of examples I was thinking about, and I don't necessarily have an answer here, but I thought it was helpful to clarify the situation. The first example is that you see a tree, or anything else, but I'm just picking a tree. You see a tree, and when you see the tree, you take a certain position with respect to the tree. But you don't really care very much or pay much attention to the position that you take. And I think that what I have in mind may become more clear if I give the second example. The second example is if we have a thought. Right? And one of the things about a thought that makes it my thought, or maybe I should say that a little differently, one of the things about a thought is that it's my thought, right? There's absolutely no doubt at all that it's my thought. But if I see a tree, I don't have that same sense of ownership. It's not my tree. And so if you say, what's the difference between those two? Well, I think that the seeing the tree, the part of it that we would say is mine, is the part that, the perception, you know, it's not the tree that's mine, but the perception of the tree is mine. And usually we don't bother to think about the perception of the tree because if everything is operating smoothly, you know, if we don't have some problem with our eyes, then it just happens automatically. But with a thought, it's different. The thinking of the thought and the content of the thought are kind of one and the same thing. So, you know, it's not enough to say, well, the thinking of the thought is mine, but the thought is not mine any more than the tree is mine. We absolutely claim ownership of the thought. And so the question, in a way, as I said, I don't have an answer or I don't have some really good way of analyzing that distinction, but it does seem to me to point to the role of positions. With the position that we take with respect to the tree is different than the position that we take with respect to the thought. Right? So the question is, what can we do with that tendency to take positions, either with respect to the thought or with respect to the tree or with respect to any other kind of experience? It seems like we are always positioning ourselves with respect to the experience. And the question is, you know, could we do it differently? Could we deposition ourselves? You know, we kind of talk about, this is not quite the language we ordinarily use, but we kind of talk about deconditioning ourselves, right? We are conditioned to react in a certain way, and we want to decondition ourselves, or we're conditioned to understand the world in a certain way, and we want to cut through that to decondition it. So the question is, how could you deposition yourself? Right? And you could think of that with respect to the tree or with respect to the thought. And the basic answer that I want to suggest is that, we could deposition ourselves by inhabiting the whole. So, ordinarily, so this becomes a kind of a space-related practice or a space-related way of thinking about things. I see that Lois has asked a question, so let me look at that. Yeah, so we're taught that the role of the self is to take positions. I think that's right. We'll look at that when we look at the bystander in just a couple of minutes. So I was starting to say that you could deposition yourself by inhabiting the whole. And what I mean by that is that, well, I guess that does take us directly into the bystander. in the later part of this chapter, Rinpoche analyzes what's going on with the bystander in some detail. And what he says is that when we take the role of the bystander, when the self becomes the bystander, then the knowing agent is the bystander, and the bystander is on the opposite pole, on the other end of whatever it is that it knows, right? So there's the knowing agent who's the bystander, and the bystander has this very specific position. And the position of the bystander is to be completely, really, in some fundamental way, to be completely separate from the world. And this goes back to something we looked at in the first program, this very strong distinction that gets made between the subjective realm and the objective realm. So now we're looking at it in a kind of a narrow sense, because the bystander is almost not yet a subject. You know, it's not a self, but it's the position the self takes. And so Lois asks in the chat section, is it the witness? Well, I don't think it's helpful to think of it in terms of the witness, because the witness, we tend to associate the bystander with the witness. When we were looking at the witness in the last program, we were looking at other possibilities other than the bystander. But here we're going back and looking at the ordinary understanding. So yeah, the bystander is the witness, but we don't want to just close it down and say that's what the witness has to be. The witness may well have to, may have other options, other openings available that go in the direction of where, you know, I'm trying to take us right now. So the suggestion or the point that I'm making is that there's this very sharp distinction, and this is what Rinpoche is saying in the chapter, this very sharp distinction between the knower, the knowing capacity, and what's known. And it's because of that, as he says, that our ordinary view of space, or our ordinary way of being in space comes up, and our ordinary way of being in time comes up. So the alternative, the approach that we can be exploring is that the self or the doesn't, let's see, let me say that differently. Let's say it in terms of space. Right now, our understanding of space is that that's where objects show up. All the things that we could possibly know show up in space. But the knowing does not show up in space. The knowing is the bystander. And that's very much the Western view. You know, if you go back to Descartes, you know, Descartes says there's two kinds of things in the world. One of them is the things that occupy space, and the other one is the thing that does the thinking, and that's the self. So this is really kind of the model. The bystander model is a lot like that. It's making the same point in a little bit different language. Tina, you're going back into that example of the tree and the difference between perceiving the tree and having a thought of the tree, and that perceiving it does seem to open things up a little bit. Well, maybe that is a good connection to what we're talking about right now, because the idea is that, let's say, when you perceive a tree, if you take a bystander view of that and you say, okay, here I am and out there is the tree and I'm perceiving it, and ordinarily we just ignore that, I mean, that whole structure, and we just say, there's a tree out there, or there's a tree. But if you import it into the world that has the tree, the knowing capacity that perceives the tree, then you would be making a break with the bystander perspective. So what I really want to suggest is that we could approach space in a way that allows the knowing to be in space as well as the known. And what that means is there's actually a nice phrase that I read once, you know, back in my days as a lawyer. There's a famous opinion which talks about a situation being instinct with obligation. That was the phrase in the law, in the legal case. It's a very unusual way of using the word instinct, but it's actually a really nice term for what I'm pointing to here. The idea is that built in to the world that we inhabit and think of as occupying space is the knowing of that space, right? Or is the knowing of that object, is a better way, is what I really mean to say. So the world is, you could say, if you want to use that phrase, is instinct with knowing. The very possibility of having any kind of perception, it depends on the knowing capacity being available for that. And we divide it up, and we say the knowing, let me get my hands up into the camera for a moment, no, that won't work. We divide it up and say the knowing capacity is somewhere else, and what we know is somewhere else too. There's a here and there's a there. There's a from and there's a to, or all these distinctions. And Rinpoche goes into some of the many dualities that grow out of this. And what I'm suggesting is that from a space perspective, and there's different ways of investigating this, you could say, no, why not understand space as also allowing the knowing of what appears in space? That's really where I'm wanting to take us and to suggest. And what that means is that the knowing is always available. You know, when in any situation, you don't bring knowing to it. And if the knowing is already available within the situation, which it almost has to be, or there couldn't be a situation, then you don't have to hold on to the bystander. You don't have to, you know, right now we think, well, there has to be someone who knows what's going on, right? But there doesn't have to be. It can be the situation itself, insofar as it appears at all, is a known situation, which means that there's knowing active within it. And the funny thing is that the bystander, by insisting on being the one that knows, drops or eliminates the possibility for knowing to be present in the world or knowing to be present in space. So the, you know, one way Rinpoche talks about this is on page 265, and I don't think you need to go there, but he talks about the bystander being over and against the world that it knows. And that is actually already built into the notion of object, which means something that's up against us. Or in German, it's even clearer. You say Gegenstand. And it means what stands over against you. So that's our ordinary understanding. What I'm suggesting is, and I think this is, you know, I mean, this comes out of the reading, is that you have this other alternative, which is to find the knowing within what appears. And so we've been talking about the tree for a while, and we say, okay, there's the activity of knowing, and so there's the perception of the tree, and that's what we claim ownership of. But in fact, the situation as a whole includes that perception. So that's kind of the difference. The same thing actually applies to our thoughts, right? There is a thought, and we claim ownership of it, and there we're very clear about it. It's my thought, darn it. But the thought is something that appears in its own space. It's not the same space as physical space, but it appears in its same space, and the knowing capacity is in the space. And so there doesn't have to be a knower. You know, there doesn't have to be a bystander who stands back and has the thought. You know? So in both those ways, both those cases, I think there's a very different alternative that is being suggested in this chapter. So Yolaine, okay, there are a couple of comments here. And Tina says, yeah, so there's the feeling to that, an opening feeling. And I think that's right. So the, you know, if we're talking about this alternative and we say, what's the flavor of it? What's the feel of a knowing that is not, does not belong to the bystander, but is in space? You know, you could talk about openness, but however you want to describe it, I think it's good to make the point, there is a feeling to it. And one way of exploring this is to explore the feeling. And Yolaine says, there's, you know, you could look at the appearing instead of the appearance, and I think that's right. It's very much like, I was saying this in some class recently, but not here, I don't think. In English, we talk about the thinking, and then we talk about the thought. And it's helpful in English that the word thought is the past tense of the verb to think. So we think something, and then once we've thought it, it's a thought. And Yolaine is pointing to something similar. There's an appearing, and then once there's this activity of appearing, it turns into an appearance, something that has appeared. But we would like to stay more with the activity of appearing, because that's more true to the notion that the knowing is active in space itself.
Jack?
Yes.
Is that then how things become polarized?
Yes, yes, exactly. This polarization, that's what we're looking at. We're looking at the bystander who takes up a polar position, and you know, the bystander disappears from the world, and I'm kind of going back now to chapter 3 or 5, I can't remember. The bystander disappears from the world because it's just the knower, but not something that can be known. And the world becomes something that that can be known, but there's no knowing in it. And we're trying to heal that split. We're trying to heal, or suggesting that we could heal, that duality. Okay. Now, was there somebody else wanted to say something? Nope. Okay. Now, in the reading for next week, we're going to start moving in a very important direction, really exploring the kind of inquiry that opens this possibility up. But the right orientation, I think, for how you do inquiry at all is in terms of this approach, that whatever it is that we experience, we find within the experience the, to use Yolaine's language here, we find the appearing or the experiencing and not simply the result of that. Or within the thought, we find the thinking. Or within the seeing of the tree, or within the tree showing up, we find the seeing of the tree. And it's when we open to all of those possibilities that we deposition ourselves. And at that point, we don't have to be stuck in the same way in our positions and our conditions. So that's it. I had a little bit more of a point I wanted to make today than I do sometimes, so I hope that was helpful. And we will move on next week and discuss more directly now this question of inquiry. But it's a, Rinpoche describes it as a free and open inquiry. And if you think of those words, you could say, well, free, that means no conditioning, and open, that means no positioning.